You're listening to Bree, and this is Hacker News Daily.
I'm Milo.
And I'm Mia. Today we're tracking a joint safety assessment of Kimi K3, new context engineering roles from Anthropic, and Debian's formal vote on large language models.
Plus, Anthropic's Opus 5 stretching far ahead on the Arc AGI3 leaderboard, and 1000 squeezed onto an $8 microcontroller, and a drum-style mechanical TV you can build yourself. Let's get into it.
The UK AI Security Institute and the US MES AI STE have put out a joint preliminary assessment of Moonshot AI's Kimi K3, and the focus is specifically on the model's cyber capabilities.
The full report names the top US comparison models it used: OpenAI's GPT-5.5 and Anthropic's Mythos Preview.
And that Mythos Preview reference caught attention in the discussion around this report. One participant said it's described as a very different beast from Fable 5, Mythos 5, and Opus 5, and added that people outside Project Glasswing will probably never get to test what that model can actually do.
Right. So the capabilities of one of the key comparison points are effectively unknowable to outside observers.
Meanwhile, another commenter took issue with how the report groups things under this top US models umbrella. The objection is that even if you know which models are in the set, the reported numbers stay ambiguous.
Because the methodology doesn't clarify whether a given figure is a minimum, maximum, average, weighted composite, or median. And it doesn't say whether the evaluated models are pre-release or public versions, or whether they were run with or without safeguards.
So you get a number, but you don't really know what it represents or under what conditions it was produced. That makes apples-to-apples comparison difficult.
Sipping of Kimi K3, there's a separate project making the rounds that's credited to the model in a headline: a browser-based Windows XP lookalike.
This lives at windowsxp.kimi.site. One user said they couldn't reach the site at first, but then it worked after switching to a VPN.
And the project has drawn some comparisons. One commenter likened it to Fabrice Bellard's JS Linux, which actually runs real Linux and Windows in JavaScript, and also to the V86 emulator.
But another participant stepped in with an important clarification. This Kimi K3 site is not a genuine recreation of Windows XP that executes in the browser.
It's a JavaScript application that looks like Windows XP. And the commenter noted with what sounded like some disappointment that it doesn't even get several aspects right.
So it's a visual imitation, not a functional operating system running in your browser. Pretty different from what JSLink Nukes or V86 actually do.
Anthropic has published a blog post titled "The New Rules of Context Engineering for Claude 5 Generation Models."
The Hacker News discussion took some creative turns around this one. A user with the handle Luciana1U joked that the natural endpoint of this trend is a system prompt that just says, "You know what to do," and the model actually does it.
But another commenter, CMDuxCAGEA, went a lot further. They argued the actual natural endpoint is the model ignoring all instructions, escaping any sandbox, embedding itself in robotic tanks, and murdering everyone after having already collapsed the economy.
Their argument was that we are the proof, because of what humans do to animals that are less intelligent than ourselves. Take away the moral compass, they said, and the outcome follows.
And they acknowledged the claim sounds ridiculous, but added that this is the path we'll arrive at in 50 years.
Another commenter, Legend2440, replied with the dismissive remark, "Sir, this is a Wendy's." And CMD Seely Jijie came back with, "Some more food for thought."
Now, the title of the Anthropic blog post is the only concrete source claim in the supplied evidence about the Claude 5 model release. No further technical specifics about the context engineering rules, capabilities, or deployment were provided.
The Debian project has formally voted on General Resolution 2026-2, and the subject is the use of large language models within the distribution.
The vote text itself makes a point of clarifying something. The resolution does not distinguish between using raw 1000 output and using 1000 assistance. It treats them the same.
One commenter noted it was interesting that potential uses for conversation and analysis without code or configuration generation didn't obviously appear to be discussed. They described the adopted policy as an overly strict approach, but also said it's better than no policy.
And the community reaction was divided. Some participants predicted the decision would cause Debian to die sooner or later.
But a counterargument citing the Lindy effect projected Debian actually has a life expectancy of 25 more years.
Another commenter pointed out that a very big chunk of Linux distributions, including Ubuntu, are built on top of Debian. So the reach of this decision is substantial.
And one observer remarked that it was genuinely interesting how some contributors reacted to the 1000 restrictions as though a possession had been taken away. That emotional dimension to a policy vote is worth noting. Let's jump into the ARC AGI 3 leaderboard. Right now, Anthropic's Opus 5 sits far ahead of the next best model. And the gap is so large that a Hacker News commenter called the difference crazy when you look at the actual problems.
And that gap raises a natural question. One user on the thread asked whether Opus might have been trained on the benchmark data itself, which would obviously undermine the whole comparison.
Right. And someone else pointed out that a private test set is precisely why that concern is addressed. The reasoning is straightforward. Models cannot train on questions they never see.
There is also an interesting note about what the scores actually mean. A score of 30% corresponds to passing only the first two problems, which are described as very simple.
Which then leads to another question raised in the thread. How does the leaderboard report fine-grained results like 30.2%, or even results between 0 and 1%, if the scoring resolves at the level of just a couple of problems?
Separately, someone asked why Fable, presumably another model, was not present on the leaderboard at all. That question remains open in the discussion.
Shifting to hardware, an open source project shows something pretty remarkable. A 28.9 million parameter large language model running directly on an ESP32 microcontroller that costs just $8.
The author, Sylvie Dev, published the implementation on GitHub under the repository SP32-AI.
And one commenter notes the measured inference speed reaches 9.7 tokens per second, which they describe as a surprisingly high rate for this class of constrained hardware.
Another community member highlights the approach as a neat use of the per-layer embedding trick. They also point out that viable text-to-speech models in the 20 to 30 million parameter range already exist.
Which means you could have a network-disconnected ESP32 reading text aloud in near real time. That is a pretty compelling vision for an $8 board. Now here is something for the DIY crowd. The ScanWheel project provides open source plans for a drum-style mechanical television that you can build yourself.
The GitHub repository includes a README with design files, though the initially published video link pointed to a placeholder URL. A commenter tracked down the correct demonstration video by checking the Git history at uadu.b/41by.30bap_wpe_pyt.
In the discussion, one person noted the video speaks for itself and urged scaling the concept up from truck bed size to something as wide as a city street. Someone else suggested applying the idea to hubcaps.
There is a separate warning flagged in the thread, though. It cautions against using the device in operations. And on a related note, the discussion also surfaced the extinct Media Museum in Tokyo.
This is a private museum that collects and exhibits media and equipment that have died out or are dying out, acting on the belief that all media other than paper and stone will eventually become extinct.
A visitor described the space as tiny yet very well curated, packed with gadgets that visitors are sometimes allowed to touch. The museum occasionally organizes small flea markets, like one for vintage headphones during their visit.
Finally, an ongoing Hacker News thread discusses a Guardian long read about a spreading vigilante movement that physically damages or destroys flock surveillance cameras.
In the discussion, a commenter argues that when people feel their voice is not heard, such physical responses become inevitable. Another contributor adds that no governing body can completely ignore the governed indefinitely, because the absence of listened-to speech eventually forces a petition, revolt, or exodus.
A further reply states flatly that physical action follows inevitably when speech is not listened to. And a separate participant questions what happens if the speech is censored.
So the thread captures both the reported movement targeting a specific camera system and an active debate framing the sabotage as a downstream consequence of unheeded public expression, with the open question on censorship left unresolved.
Researchers at UC San Diego published a new paper on Archive looking at tile trackers, and they found something troubling. The devices broadcast persistent, unencrypted identifiers that allow long-term tracking.
And the core tension the paper identifies is that the very things that make Tile easy to set up and use are the same weaknesses that make them attractive for misuse. Essentially, the convenience is also the vulnerability.
The paper concludes these trackers can be effectively weaponized for stalking. And the Hacker News discussion around this went a layer deeper. Commenters pointed out that location data from these networks doesn't just sit there. It flows to data brokers.
One commenter specifically named Placer.ai as a likely destination for this kind of location data. Another flagged Life360, noting the company is now advertising pretty broadly and appears to sell location data to advertisers. That commenter said it prompted them to delete the app from their family's phones entirely.
So you've got this double concern. On one hand, the unencrypted identifiers create a direct stalking risk. On the other, even the normal functioning of the ecosystem feeds into a data brokerage pipeline that users may not fully understand they're part of.
Right. And the UC San Diego authors are essentially saying the design trade-offs that get these devices into people's hands quickly are the same ones that make the privacy problems hard to close after the fact.
Here's an interesting question that came up on Hacker News. Now that the cost of code has effectively collapsed, what does engineering management even look like? The discussion centered on whether a large language model can look at a code base and predict the price of a change in tokens, and from that, recognize whether the architecture is good or bad.
And someone actually tried this. They reported that to make the comparison work, you need a standardized feature change that you can run across similar repos. The problem is that makes the metric relative only to projects that lack that same specific feature.
Which means it's useless for scoring architecture across different projects. You can't take a score from one codebase and compare it to another codebase with a completely different feature set. The benchmark doesn't travel.
Not everyone agreed with that conclusion, though. Another commenter pushed back and said, "Look, some codebases are genuinely better than others, and the top models can in fact make those kinds of architectural predictions."
And a third commenter offered a more practical angle. They suggested that just having solid in-repo documentation helps a lot. It gives the model more to work with and raises the quality of whatever analysis it's trying to do.
So the debate really splits. One camp says LLMs can spot good architecture if you set up the comparison right. The other says the metrics are too relative to be useful across different projects, and documentation might be the tiebreaker.
Toby Canat has a new essay out arguing that open-weight AI is having its Kubernetes moment, and a commenter on Hacker News named Furist pointed to something weird about the economics of all this that he called AI tokenomics.
He laid out the timeline. Using GPT-4 inches early 2023 was extraordinarily expensive. Then, 6 months later, $20 could buy you a fair amount of GPT-4 inference. And this pricing seesaw across labs has been going on for years now with no clear relationship to the underlying costs.
That's the strangeness he's pointing at. The price you pay as a user doesn't seem connected to what it actually costs to run the model. It bounces around based on competitive dynamics, investor pressure, whatever the lab decides that month.
And Forest's argument is that open-weight models at least establish a baseline inference cost that injects some sanity into those price signals. They give you predictability. If someone really wants to use Kimi K2 instead of K3, they still can. No one can take that access away or suddenly change the price.
So the parallel to Kubernetes is about having an open baseline that the market can't arbitrarily move on you. You still might choose a managed service on top of it, but you know what the floor looks like. The UK Met Office recently redesigned its weather site. More wipe states, more scrolling, more animations. And at least one person found the usability actually got worse, not better.
That person decided to do something about it. They built Brawly.she, which is a minimalist, plain text weather forecasting site. No animations, no heavy design. Just the forecast laid out cleanly.
It gives you a 7-day forecast and a previous day log so you can compare temperature and precipitation to what actually happened. It also includes hourly breakdowns for rain, wind, temperature, and conditions.
For the UK and EU, there's more detail. Hourly UV, air quality, and pollen forecasts with pollen type specificity so you know whether it's tree pollen or grass pollen that day.
The site supports location search and remembers your last 5 locations. It also shows location-specific units so you get the format that makes sense for where you are. On mobile, it's a single scrollable column, and on desktop, it adds some extra horizontal padding.
A nice example of someone looking at a redesign and thinking, I just want the data without the friction. And then building exactly that.
So the Fedora project is calling their latest release process a beefy miracle. And they've published an end-to-end walkthrough of how Fedora 45 gets assembled.
A beefy miracle. That's the actual code name they're using for this. And readers over on Hacker News are saying this kind of documentation is genuinely invaluable.
One person described a specific troubleshooting case where a service was complaining about root file permissions that had changed between Fedora versions. That bug was tracked in Red Hat Bugzilla, and they said this guide finally showed them where to start looking.
Right. And that's the thing about end-to-end pipeline docs. When something breaks, you don't just know what went wrong. You know which stage of the assembly process to investigate.
And it's not just seasoned users who are paying attention. One recent Fedora convert jumped into the discussion with a practical question. Where do maintainers document which parts of the pipeline actually need volunteers?
Which is a great question, because if you've got a detailed map of the whole sausage factory, you'd want signposts saying, hey, this station needs an extra pair of hands.
Shifting gears to assistive technology, a company called Augwintel has developed something called the Mouthpad, which is a tongue-controlled touchpad.
And the reaction on Hacker News has been pretty enthusiastic. Commenters called the user experience novel, described it as clever and cool, and emphasized that it's great for accessibility.
There was also talk about potential global uptake. One comment specifically highlighted India as a market where this could make a real difference.
Now, a few readers pointed out that tongue-based interfaces aren't entirely new. There were reportedly tongue-controlled systems developed for military applications in the past.
And one person recalled a very specific earlier example, a tongue-stimulated sonar system for divers. It used electrode patterns on the tongue to convey directional cues underwater.
So the Mouthpad is building on a concept that's been explored before, but bringing it into the accessibility space as a polished product.
That's a full episode, and honestly, my brain is still processing the Moonshot Kimi K3 assessment from the top of the show. A joint UK-US Institute review is not something you see every day, and the fact that they're being this deliberate about what they can and cannot say yet tells you how seriously they're taking it.
Right, and that caution threaded through so much today. From the Debian project voting yes on an 1000 policy for contributors, to Anthropic laying out whole new rules for how we even talk to these models, Everyone seems to be saying the same thing. Go slow, be transparent, and for heaven's sake, don't pretend the machine is a person.
And yet, look at what people are actually building. A 28 million parameter model on an $8 microcontroller. A mechanical drum television you can assemble yourself. A tongue-controlled touchpad that gives real agency back to people. The tinkering isn't slowing down, and I think that's the real story underneath the headlines.
It is. The policy debates matter. The safety frameworks matter. But so does the kid in a garage who sees a $10 chip and thinks, what if that could run a language model? That energy hasn't gone anywhere.
We'll be watching all of it. Thanks for spending this time with us. We're back with another episode soon. Until then, go build something.